Yeah, somehow it's always hard to take things seriously. So yes, I always think of myself as having corrupted Graham for those that are in the know. So I kind of got a bit intimidated by the title of the conference being the structure of space-time or quantum gravity. So I thought, well, you know, how can I kind of link what I'm doing into that? And I realized that some of my recent work, which I'd like to tell you about, is actually a little bit in this direction, in the sense of I'm always trying to think about different ways gravity can kind of seep into areas, research areas, where you didn't necessarily think it was possible, or the bulk of people working in that area maybe don't think about gravity. And in fact, this particular research that I'm going to tell you about also has led to me being part of a proposal in Britain, a larger experimental proposal, which is actually to test different aspects of relativistic field theory. So I may come back to some of that at the end, but there is a sort of genuine sense, maybe not testing directly quantum gravity, but just testing some aspects of the things that we work with when we do quantum fields or in gravity or quantum gravity. So quick outline, the talk's going to be about tunneling. So I'll first of all kind of set that up, and I'll give you the standard law, the standard picture about gravity and tunneling. Then I'll talk about what myself and collaborators, a list of whom are on the first slide, have been doing, including black holes in tunneling. And then I'll tell you a bit about how we might be testing tunneling. So in a sense, this is exploring quantum gravity in a sense. And I often sort of think of the Big Bang Theory when I think of quantum gravity, you know, in the sense of all these different notions or different ways of grappling with how we approach this fundamental structure of space-time at the Planck scale. I'm not actually going to be addressing that. I mean, I picked out of some of the talks that this notion, and in fact, this sort of implication of whatever your favorite theory is, of the fundamental structure of space-time seems to only appear when you get very, very close to the Planck scale. On the other hand, there's also this idea that we feel that maybe some effects of quantum gravity should be leaking out far sooner. So here I'm referring to firewalls or Nyasha's echoes from black holes. So even though we think that our fundamental theory of quantum gravity should only appear at the Planck scale, maybe some effects might appear before that. So that's more really the sort of spirit of what I'm going to be talking about. And I'm going to be taking, in a sense, not surprisingly, coming from the damped relativity group, a sort of Gibbons-Hawking type of approach to quantum gravity, in that I'm going to be thinking about tiptoeing through Euclidean quantum gravity and calculations with non-perturbative solutions in gravity. I know that people tend to be more skeptical about these sort of calculations that I'm going to be presenting, but in fact, I don't think they should be, because people are totally happy about the predictions of inflation for the microwave background, and that is simply using semi-classical quantum techniques. So it is using notions of how space-time behaves. So we take our classical background and quantize over it. So that is taking a sort of step-by-step approach. Let's take the next logical step, given the theories we have. And so in a sense, this Euclidean approach to quantum gravity is very much in that sort of philosophy, I guess, of taking the next logical step. And, you know, I think it's always good to keep taking the next logical steps, because then if you end up in a dog's breakfast, then it's kind of may give you a clue as to which step needs to be modified. So quantum tunneling, this was really the standard picture that when people know about how to describe quantum tunneling, and in particular how to include gravity, the standard picture that they have tends to be that of developed by Coleman, amongst others. And this was developed in the 1970s, when people were really getting quite comfortable with field theory and felt they knew what they were doing. And the vacuum was sort of understood as a sort of derived concept, if you like. It was sort of usually defined by some scalar field, and it was basically a minimum of some energy function. And it was also understood that this potential could depend on temperature and also the scale at which you're probing it. And so here there's this notion that you're, this is meant to be what I'm going to come to later, the Higgs potential, the idea that at very large scales, you can actually have strong corrections to your effective potential. So I like to motivate this, the tools or the methodology of Coleman and Co. I like this low-tech pointer. I'm going to stick with it. I guess I kind of like to think of it or motivate it, just going back to something where I feel I kind of know what's going on, and that is the Schrödinger equation. So if you're in one spatial dimension, and this sort of classic calculation that you do when you first learn about quantum mechanics is you have an incident wave function on a potential barrier, and there some of it is reflected, and of course the magic of quantum mechanics tells you some is transmitted. Why is it nice? Because you can just solve it exactly. And you solve your Schrödinger equation and you find that the probability of transmission has an exact form related to, if I assume the incident amplitude is one, and this is dominated by an exponential decay. And so underneath the barrier, your wave function doesn't automatically go to zero, it just exponentially decays, and it's the rate of decay that tells you about this tunneling probability. And there's a nice trick that you can do to calculate that leading order exponential form, which is to Euclideanize, and you Wick rotate to Euclidean time, and you notice that the integral that you want to calculate, which is appearing in the exponential, you can kind of go through a few steps to show that that integral is nothing other than the Euclidean action for a classical motion of a particle in the inverted well. So at this point, I'm calling it a Euclidean trick deliberately because although it's kind of related to this Gibbons-Hawking path integral approach, it's nonetheless not clear. It is sort of a trick, it's a method, and it's not really clear that you're assigning any reality to the imaginary time. So this was then generalized in a nice sort of paper by Banks, Bender, and Wu thinking about multidimensional tunneling and using that as a stepping stone to the field theory, tunneling and field theory. And so there's this idea of a most probable escape path. So in essence, your wave function always wants to go through the lowest point of the barrier. And so that sort of generalizes to the field theory where you want to sort of take this minimal approach or your stationary path. So why should we sort of worry about this? Is this just an abstract thing? Well, not really, because now that we've got actual confirmation that there is a scalar field in nature, vis-a-vis the Higgs from the LHC, you kind of look at how the Higgs potential runs with scale, and it depends on the masses of other particles, but in particular, the heaviest one, the top quark, which is the least well known. And so when you look at what the Higgs mass is and the sort of range of the top mass, we find ourselves in this little region of space where our Higgs vacuum is metastable. It's not actually stable. So this is a kind of zooming in. Here we are with where we sort of our preferred spot as far as the LHC is concerned, is in this region where the vacuum that we're in with the Higgs is not actually the lowest energy state. So we have this bigger picture of the Higgs potential actually turning over and becoming negative at very large scales. So our universe is not entirely stable. And so just sort of nomenclature, we call the vacuum that is a local but not global minimum a false vacuum. And then we expect that we tunnel to the so-called true vacuum, which is the true minimum of the Higgs potential. And so this gives rise to a first order phase transition because we have to cross that barrier. And so we can, this sort of comes at a cost. So we get bubbles of the true vacuum. And this is what Coleman and collaborators explored in the 70s. And so the nice thing about Coleman's description of this is it's very intuitive, quite pictorial, and although it's approximate, it's easy to understand. So in his picture, you have the false vacuum, and then a bubble of true vacuum sort of suddenly appears, and then it expands. And it's, we can get a very intuitive explanation of the probability of this process by thinking of the so-called Goldilocks bubble. Now, again, Goldilocks, the tale of Goldilocks is not necessarily one that is pan-cultural. So the idea of Goldilocks is she was a little girl who went in the wood and found a house and went in, and she kept trying things out. So there were chairs, one was too tall, one was too short, one was just right. The bowls of porridge, one was too hot, too cold, just right, etc. And so the idea there is this notion of something being too much one way, too much the other way, or just right. And so here for the bubble, if the bubble is too small, it has too much surface area. So you have these two competing factors. You gain energy by tunneling to the true vacuum, but you lose energy because you've got to pay for making the bubble wall. Too small, surface area dominates. Too big, and it's too expensive to form. But the just right bubble is just the right size that it doesn't recollapse and it's still cheap enough to form. And so then it continues to expand. From this Euclidean trig perspective, you're constructing a Euclidean solution to the field equations where outside you're in a false vacuum, which I'm kind of denoting by lambda plus. Inside you're in a true vacuum, which I'm denoting by lambda minus. The bubble has a radius r, and there's a wall of energy between the two. So your energy cost is the energy per unit area of the wall, sigma, or the tension, times the area. And the energy gain is the difference in vacuum energy, epsilon, times the interior volume. You then...
Are these related at all to the nucleation rate?
Yeah, that's what I'm... Yes. Oh. What we're doing is we're trying to find... So the motivation of the Euclidean trick was to find the solution that sort of minimises this most probable escape path, find a solution that minimises the cost, and then that gives you the exponent, which appears in the amplitude for decay.
Okay, so that's going to be dependent on the width of the barrier?
The energy cost here, sigma, so how high the barrier is, the width, the overall sort of how much you've got to tunnel through, that tells you about the width, this tension of the wall. And then the energy gain is simply the difference in vacuum energies. Okay. Here I am taking a situation where, you know, the Coleman description kind of applies best where you've got two distinct minima it's probably slightly less. My epsilon is too big there. So here's my epsilon, and this thing tells you, gives you sigma, if you like.
Sorry, it's a very naive question. What's the intuition behind calling the tunneling solution a bounce?
So the bounce was because if you go back to the Schrödinger issue, the ball kind of drops down, goes across, comes up, and then goes back again. So typically, like if you think of alpha decay, you kind of reverse this potential here. There we go. So you're starting from here. Your classical trajectory kind of goes there and then comes back again. So it's the Hobbit one, the there and back again. So that they called it the bounce because it kind of went and bounced back. And it's the whole sort of process that gives you the Euclidean action. In this case, it's a bit different, but you could use a bounce as saying you start in the false vacuum, you get your bubble of a, you know, at this sort of maximal surface here, and then it goes back again. Sort of think of it there. So the bounce was just something that became what people called it in the 70s when they were developing this. I mean, we would call it, I think instanton is really what we'd call it now, because that's our Euclidean solution. So we want our solution, we make things stationary with respect to the size of the bubble, and it gives us a value for R, which we can then input back in to give us our bounce action. Sorry about the phrase, bounce action. And it goes like the tension to the fourth over the vacuum energy difference cubed. And so our tunneling amplitude to leading order is the exponential of this. So that is Coleman's description. And although this, what I just described, makes an assumption that the wall is very thin, if you actually solve the full Euclidean equations for a sort of general thick wall, this is a very good approximation to the actual answer until your sort of barrier gets shallow and, you know, the energy difference becomes larger. So it's a good approximation, and it's very intuitive, and you can kind of draw pictures and think about how it happens. Obviously, that's just a leading order. It's the saddle point. You have to think about fluctuations around the saddle point, and that's, of course, where things tend to get a bit hairy once you include gravity. But in essence, this is what Coleman derived, a probability of decay per unit volume, per unit time, which was given as this bounce action plus fluctuations around this background. So does this Euclidean solution actually mean...
Is the volume for here?
So in that case, that was per unit volume, per unit time. So that so it's 40, yeah. So one of the little pointers I just wanted to make is whether... You know, how much do you trust this Euclidean calculation? So I know that Neil and others are trying to push this question about whether one should do things in Euclidean time or real time. I think my perspective is simply that it's a tool. It's a means of doing a calculation. And maybe it is something that you should question and test, and that's something, again, I'll come back to. So our bubble was a round thing in Euclidean time, which means that the spatial radius squared plus the Euclidean time squared is some constant. So if we analytically continue back to real time, we now get r squared minus t squared is a constant. And so that's the equation for a hyperboloid. So we also have a Lorentzian bubble solution, which is a solution of a bubble that is expanding at accelerating at uniform, expanding at uniform acceleration. And so we have this dual Euclidean picture and Lorentzian picture that corresponds to the bubble. And so the conventional description is that you cut it at sort of t equals zero. You say that the bubble, the real bubble, it appears at t equals zero and expands. And somehow you glue it to the Euclidean bubble. I'm not sure about that, whether that's really anything other than a nice picture. Okay, so that's Coleman's original picture and the sort of QFT picture of tunneling. But of course, once you start talking about vacuum energy, you have to think about gravity, because vacuum energy gravitates. And so for de Sitter space, I'm going to do de Sitter to flat because it's easiest to draw pictures for that, but it doesn't have to be that way. De Sitter space is represented as a hyperboloid in five dimensions, a five-dimensional Lorentzian space. And you can cut that hyperboloid in all sorts of different ways. So you have different coordinate systems for de Sitter. So here's, this is the global one, where all of your de Sitter space is covered by your coordinates. So as I said, I'm taking this standard kind of Euclidean approach to including gravity in this fundamentally quantum calculation. So here was the calculation, the sort of bit that Coleman did originally. And then the idea is to add the Einstein-Hilbert action and recompute and refine your bubble, refine the action, and therefore the amplitude for decay. The saddle point, well, the fluctuations, of course, have to be treated with caution, but in the end, I'm probably going to pass off problems of fluctuations to those who truly work in quantum gravity. But saddle points are unambiguous, so I'm going to stick to the saddle point at the moment. So here's the picture. We know what de Sitter space is, Lorentzian, Euclidean. And so the instanton, this bubble, bounce, whatever, should take this sphere of false vacuum and replace some of it with flat space if we're tunneling, if the true vacuum is flat space. So that means I can draw my bubble by taking the sphere, and the radius of this sphere is related to lambda, so it kind of goes like the inverse radius of the sphere squared gives me lambda, and I simply cut the nose off the sphere and replace it with something flat. So here's my true vacuum. The wall is this sort of place where the space-time kinks a bit. And here's the false vacuum. So this is what my instanton looks like. And Coleman returned to this in the 80s with Frank de Lucia to compute this new gravitational instanton. And so this is just a picture of what it looks like. You can still do this Goldilocks game because you can still find the energy of the wall. You can still find the cost of making the wall. You can find the gain of exiting from the false vacuum. The thing that's slightly different is, of course, now you've got a sphere, so the volume inside, the volume of would-be false vacuum is now not a sort of flat geometry, it's like the sort of cap of the sphere. So you can see that the sort of balance, if you like, of the energy budget changes a bit because of the curved geometry. But that's all. It's sort of very similar, just looks a little more complicated. So you make this stationary with respect to the radius of the sphere, and you find the solution and can find the action, which is, it's not so obvious that this is the same, but remember L squared is like 1 over the energy difference, so we've got an L to the 6, so there's our 1 over epsilon cubed, and you can sort of see a sigma to the 4th there. So you can kind of see it has the same shape. So that was, there anything else I wanted to say there? Yeah, so that's the Coleman de Lucia argument. What they actually did, of course, was not to do it from this perspective, but they solved the Einstein equations, which one can do for a domain wall, and got this action. So if one goes back to the Higgs and puts in the parameters into this Coleman de Lucia result, you find the half-life is sort of 10 to the 130-odd years. So you think, great, break out the champagne, no problem, who cares what the LHC found for, you know, even if it says the vacuum's unstable, doesn't matter because the probability is so low. However, the question that I'd been thinking about with a postdoc in Durham about 5 or 6 years ago, Ben Withers, we were sort of quite interested in thinking about inflation and thinking about how, you know, the fact that everything is always very smooth and idealized. So we kind of got to wondering what happens if you put inhomogeneities in. And so in this case, although I've got two pictures here, what used to strike me was that because the voltage here is half of that in Europe, kettles take forever to boil. So I noticed people would put mugs of water in the microwave to heat them up for a cup of tea. And so that's what I would do. And then I would notice that when I put the tea bag in, the water would suddenly sort of fizz and become very active because it had gone from being a sort of smooth cup of water to adding an inhomogeneity. So you had to be kind of careful about how long you put the microwave on for. So this is kind of the effect here. You know, you can maybe have this superheated state. You pop in an impurity and whoosh, you know, you kind of catalyze a phase transition and don't get your cup of tea, but get some interesting physics. So that's what we kind of did.
And you put the tea bag in the microwave with the water?
No. The brewing process, don't tell a Brit how to make tea. The brewing process has to be where the hot water hits the tea leaf. But anyway, apparently. Anyway.
What sort of phenomenon?
Oh, here we go. So we wanted to put in an inhomogeneity, because I kind of tend to be a bit of a pen and paper gal, it had to be something that was simple and clean. And what other than a black hole? So note, so that you sort of think about this bubble of Coleman's and say, well, I'm just going to pop a black hole down in the middle of it. The other thing is actually that because of all the symmetries, you've reduced the symmetry a little bit, but only a little. You've just broken one bit of the symmetry. So this is still fully integrable when you look at the Einstein equations for this thin wall. So the bulk is integrable, and you can therefore solve this space-time by simply doing matching conditions, Israel conditions, across the wall. And so that's on the left, a sort of picture of what we thought of doing. On the right is kind of a Euclidean picture, because from a Euclidean perspective, the black hole looks like a cigar. So you can sort of tell that it was discovered by Guys or Steve and Gary, because they called it a cigar, right? So anyway, the idea is this is a Euclidean black hole, and so you're kind of putting your wall, somehow wrapping it around this Euclidean black hole. So if, again, you want to play that Goldilocks trick, the idea is you've got a bubble, a black hole inside. You can have a different mass term outside, which would be what you would regard as a seed. So the idea is you start with a black hole, then the bubble forms, and the mass of the black hole has changed. So this is a space-time that you can solve for. And in general, your bubble wall will have some time, Euclidean or Lorentzian time dependence. But for every given seed mass, there's a unique bubble with lowest action. So you can find solutions for a range of different remnants and seeds, but only one is going to have the lowest action for a given seed. And because this action is then exponentiated to get the probability for decay, this will be the most probable escape path equivalent.
So this will also dominate multiple black holes?
So each one, so usually the bubble falls around a single, so I'm only considering the one, yeah, here. I mean, that's a different, interesting question. So broadly speaking, for a very, very small seed mass, you have just a deformed Coleman de Lucia instanton. But for larger seed masses, and this has no remnant black hole, for larger seed masses, you have like a static instanton, and a remnant. Now, it turns out this second case is the relevant one. So, because the small seed masses are basically nudging right up against the Planck scale in the real quantum gravity picture. So, this is the case that we found was relevant. And when you compute the action, you find that a load of junk just falls away, and the action just ends up being the difference in area between the seed and remnant black holes. In other words, the difference in entropy between the two configurations, which is kind of nice that the sort of probability for going from one entropy to a lower entropy, the chance of a process that happening is, of course, e to the minus entropy difference. So this kind of all fits together nicely. Now, where are we with time?
You still have about 10 minutes.
Okay, so I'm not going to go through these next two slides in detail. It's just part of the technicalities. I mentioned that the Euclidean black hole is periodic. Well, typically the Instanton itself also has a natural periodicity. So one of the things that you end up having to do is to deal with conical deficits and integrating over conical deficits when you do the Euclidean action. And that is actually absolutely crucial to getting the right answer.
So usually when one goes away from this most symmetric case, mm-hmm. The half sphere, etc., mm-hmm. then this issue of regularity conditions arises. Right. So what do you allow? What you call maybe matching conditions. Right? What do you allow going? How do your solutions match, and how does this affect the Euclidean?
So I'm worried that I may be meaning something different by matching. So that's why I'm sort of looking slightly.
I looked at it a lot. No, it's just straightforward matching, actually. So you have got one periodicity, another periodicity, and you're matching it. So there is actually.
What happens to the
metric?
Yeah.
So you have to. So this is just meant to indicate that you need to sort of shrink to make sure you have the same Euclidean periodicity.
But it's not smooth.
It's just continuous. It's not even differentiable. But then, it's a question of how unique is this also.
So the conical deficit is kind of the cleanest of singularities in a way because so what we did was we smoothed it over to just take a limit to compute the action. And if it makes you feel better, we computed the Coleman de Lucia instanton in a static patch, which also has a conical deficit, and we get the exact same answer using this procedure. So there is, and finally, the instanton itself doesn't have any conical singularity. It's simply the subtraction of the background you have to deal with integrating a conical singularity.
Well, it's not that it makes me feel uncomfortable, but typically it implies, of course, as you also emphasized, you think about this as just a trick, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Inside. So any choices one makes there, they can be natural or maybe unnatural, they will kind of encode ultimately Lorentzian behavior.
Right, but we found that the action that we get is in the end independent of any. The true answer to your question may require a bit of nitty gritty, but all I can say is that the answer that we get is a geometric answer, which is just dependent on the areas of the two black hole horizons. So there's no ambiguity in that, and if we were to alter our periodicity, we still get the same answer for our instanton. But it's the devil's in the details there. So I'm not sure I can give you a absolutely hardcore answer to that. But I'm happy to show you a bit more detail offline. So this is the result. And so the general message is that cedar tunneling ends up being much more likely than the standard Coleman de Lucia tunneling. So the black hole, as an impurity, does seed vacuum decay. However, if we're going to think about black holes now in this more quantum sense, we should also think about other processes that can happen with the black hole, namely evaporation. So we know our temperature is inversely proportional to the mass, and black holes with a temperature higher than the CMB will radiate, they lose mass, they get hotter, etc. So this gives us the process of black hole evaporation. So we have to compare our evaporation rate with this tunneling half-life. And so that is, we can sort of, we know that our bounce is the difference in the areas of the black hole horizons. We then kind of use some numerical results to notice that, in fact, this difference between the seed and remnant black hole is relatively constant. It doesn't change so much as the seed mass changes. So we get our sort of branching ratio for the decay to, sorry, that's the decay rate to the Hawking evaporation rate. The decay rate is roughly exponential in terms of the seed mass, whereas, of course, the evaporation rate is polynomial, it's power law. So we have to compare these two, and whether or not decay will dominate is all dependent on prefactors. So we estimated our prefactor on dimensional grounds, and then looked at the answer. So this plot, we obviously what I've talked about so far was this sort of semi-analytic argument about thin walls. That is not what the Higgs potential is. The Higgs potential has very, very thick walls that you have to find numerically. So what we did was we kind of by hand added in an ad hoc correction to the Higgs potential to give it a minimum so that we could take this thin wall and then we kind of switched that off. So here, this is the thin wall analytic computation, and from the blue stepping in is going from no very, very thick wall to gradually switching on the ad hoc term and moving towards thin wall. So in fact, doing the numerical Euclidean solution for the real Higgs potential, close to the real Higgs potential, is showing you that the range of black hole masses for which cedar decay dominates Hawking evaporation is sort of gets bigger. So this is in terms of Planck masses. So here we're sort of 6-7 orders below the Planck scale. So that's definitely a regime where you kind of believe these semi-classical results. And of course, this means that this process is relevant for primordial black holes. So, so we kind of thought, what we're saying is that if we have a primordial black hole that is below a certain mass, it will evaporate and then it will come down to this danger range in real time. So just looking at time and thinking about what I want to say. So basically primordial black holes can be a problem. So we can view this as kind of a link between your sort of Higgs potential and the primordial black hole distribution. So it's more or less saying that we can't have any primordial black holes that are decaying now. So in the last 5 minutes, I just want to talk about what is this about testing this decay. So this is really coming to some recent ideas by Drummond and et al. And also by your local Matt Johnson and friends on whether or not you can actually use cold atom systems Bose-Einstein condensates to analyze relativistic vacuum decay. So it turns out if you set up a Bose gas in a particular, very specific setup, which I'm not expert in, you can find you have sort of a system where you have two spins. If they're aligned, that's kind of the vacuum state. If they are counter-aligned, then that is not a false vacuum, it's actually a tachyonic state. But the idea of Drummond and co. was to say, to add a sort of small modulation of a microwave field, and I'm probably not going to, but it's this idea of stabilizing something in an unstable position by wiggling it a little bit. And so that gives you an effective false vacuum. So that's sort of the notion of this setup. And so the only proviso, which I just want to say, because it's kind of part of one of the things that we need to explore, is that Matt and friends found that associated with this oscillating microwave field, there was also a sort of Floch A instability. So we do need to, I'll come back to that. So here is, we have two states for our system, and we can parameterize them by a sort of average density, a relative phase, and a common phase. And what we were interested in was testing cedar tunneling. So Matt and friends have been looking at this in 1+1 dimensions, so we were looking at it in 2+1 dimensions, because we can introduce a seed via a relative phase, sort of knot or vortex. So we can look at the Coleman decay. Because this now is sort of a slightly messier system, our fundamental equation for these psis is non-relativistic. We had to kind of think a little bit about how to generalize Coleman decay, but we more or less can. So here's the pure false vacuum, with the spins misaligned. And then the idea is a bubble sort of forms where the spins kind of rotate in the center. Our seed is a vortex, which actually has the same sort of behavior as a global cosmic string, for those that like those things. and here is our vortex, where our sort of phase rotates as we circulate around the origin. So we can calculate our seeded bubbles. So this is sort of a representation of the bubble, which is now no longer round in the Euclidean time. And then we can compare seeded rates, which are the dotted lines, seeded actions with unseeded actions. So again, the seeded action is actually lower. So once again, seeded decay dominates. And I just want to sort of finish off, we've actually got a genuine atomic physicist on the collaboration who also tried this via an alternate approach, again, that Matt and collaborators are also utilizing, which is a truncated Wigner approximation, where the idea is you simply, because the vacuum is, of course, not clean and simple, it's, you know, got lots of zero-point energies, so you kind of populate these states. So now, is this going to work? Nope. Not sure this is going to work. There we go. So, seeded decay. Nope. And unseeded. It's not going to work. Right. On the right was the seeded decay. On the left is the unseeded decay. And even though I screwed up with my timing, you can kind of see there's quite a big difference. Okay. So just to wrap up, if it's going to let me. Oh, no. Oh, dear. Now I've really screwed up.
Play from current slide, try not.
Yeah, but the current slide, I think, is the first one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just give the whole topic.
Okay. 1, 2, 3. Just because you missed the first few slides, Rob. I'll tell it again!
And
okay.
Can you go back to the beginning?
Is it really worth it for the last slide, I wonder? Okay, yay, sorry about that. Okay, so I've just talked about vacuum decay, and, you know, because it's something that I've become interested in and thinking about, trying to move away from such idealized calculations and introducing some sort of inhomogeneity. The answer is, just like in normal phase transitions in nature, impurities have a strong effect. They do catalyze decay. And this is important in the sense of whether very small mass primordial black holes exist, or whether indeed the Standard Model vacuum is metastable. So I got to the end to try and give a bit of an idea about some of the things that we're planning to examine with the vacuum tunneling. We do have to sidestep this instability. One of the things that we're thinking about is looking at finite temperature tunneling, which is sort of relevant, most experiments. We've also been developing an alternate system, three-component system, which doesn't use this sort of oscillatory microwave field. We're also not entirely sure that this truncated Wigner approximation is the right thing to do. And I'll stop there.
Understand correctly the scenario, in the early universe we would have this tunneling that whose probability is encountered by the presence of primordial black holes. And my question is, so what happens to the primordial black holes that whose environment undergo a change in the environment?
So first of all, this is not actually thinking about the early universe, this is thinking about now.
Oh.
because it's now that we are sitting in potentially a metastable false vacuum for the Higgs. So it's now that this is applying to, and primordial black holes that are too light, if you like, that are now evaporating. So what this says is, you know, again, presupposing the whole sort of premise of the calculation is correct, but then, as I say, it's as reasonable as other semi-classical approaches. Then if you have suddenly blanked on what I was about to say there. Sorry. So what was your question?
What happens to black holes?
So I think if there's a single primordial black hole in our past light cone, then that would have catalyzed decay. So we cannot have a single primordial black hole of, I think, which would be below 5 × 10^14 grams when it was formed. We cannot have a single one of those in our past light cone.
Or we'd all be dead.
Yep. We just wouldn't be here, yeah. So that's all it's saying. It's relating an absence of light black holes to the Higgs vacuum.
I'm curious about what this means from the point of view of black hole physics rather than cosmology.
Yeah.
Does this mean that if there is a scalar field with some sort of false vacuum, that a typical black hole will never decay to Planck size because it will undergo this phase transition first,
yes,
and therefore people who worry about black hole information should be worrying about it in an entirely different context.
Well, that's a different way of thinking. Yeah, it's a different way of thinking about it. Yes,
black hole.
Now, putting that point, because I mean the information paradox is for a very big black hole, and these are tiny. So.
No, but
it's the same sort of notion.
It only matters when. If the black hole finally disappears at the end.
But no, the paradox is at the page time. So.
Well, presuming it then evaporates. But we still get left with the black hole inside these bubbles.
Yeah.
Mm. So,
a remnant,
yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, you do still have a remnant.
We still have a remnant, so I'm not sure, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the information is captured in those remnants.
Yeah. Okay, but then
so
the remnant.
They can be arbitrarily small.
But then the remnant.
Then the remnant has a problem, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You've tucked it away into the bubble.
Yeah.
Well, it's just to get back to the lifetime of the universe. So if I got this right, without any black hole seeds, it's 10^800 years or something. Lifetime.
Yeah, or 138 or something, yeah.
But anyway,
mm-hmm.
With a seed that's as big as, 10^14?
At formation, so primordial black holes that are above, I think, 5 × 10^14 grams have not evaporated by now. So it's the mass of the black hole at formation. But the time when it catalyzes is when it's about a metric ton, roughly.
Okay, but we can't tolerate even one of those.
Not even one, no.
So my question is, what's the tolerance level for us to live long enough? How many can we tolerate at what mass?
That was sort of what the picture way back here was, very quickly. So this is looking at the initial mass, the mass at formation, versus, so this is something to do with the sort of spectrum of the fluctuations that produce primordial black holes. So we found that, in essence, if you had primordial black holes forming, there's a very, you know, at this mass, then there would be one in a past light cone. So there's a really, really sharp cutoff in the mass, sort of allowed, of a primordial black hole, at the mass at formation allowed. So it's okay to have primordial black holes that are dark matter, so that are sort of, say, 10^16 grams at formation, for now.
So you don't.
And in our lifetime, Rob, right? You know.
Exactly that. We want a plot of the mass of the black hole versus years.
Oh, I see. Right, okay. A new environmental catastrophe, yes. Okay.
Measurements of the top mass from
okay.
CMS mm-hmm. and Atlas that came out this spring that were direct measurements of the top mass, and they put the top mass in, I think, 171 GeV.
Mm-hmm.
So in any case, in the just stable regions, so maybe there's...
So maybe, okay, all right. Yeah.
So maybe that's a good
point to stop, yeah.
The coffee break in the morning.